I'm going to lose 30 prestige due to the poverty.
Well, I'm going to be significantly more
crushed. Yeah. Crushed under the weight of poverty. Poverty doesn't pay.
Poverty never pays. Crime pays.
Crime sometimes. Poverty on the land never pays.
Welcome to Which Game First, where we boldly explore the hilariously huge world of board games. Did we find any hidden treasures you've been missing out on? Let's find out. First up, we play a high-stakes game of hide-and-seek somewhere in the city, in Spyfall 2. Then we try to avoid crushing poverty in the game London. And finally, can we make a viral marketing coup in the t-shirt game? I'm your host, Celeste DeAngelis. Now let's meet the rest of our brave and intrepid panel.
Hi, I'm Evan Bernstein, and I'm a first edition made in the year 1969.
Hi. I'm Ed Povilaitis, and I showed the blue pill.
I'm Joe Unfried, and I never met a honey badger I didn't like.
Hi, I'm Mike Rainier, and I mean it. Anybody want a peanut?
Peanut.
All right.
A little Princess Bride for you.
Our first game up this week is Spyfall 2, designed by Alexander Ushin. The edition we played is by Cryptozoic from 2017. Number of players, 3 to 12, ages 13 plus, and the runtime is 15 minutes and up. Mike, you brought this game to the table. Where'd you find it?
I discovered Spyfall at a game designers convention in New Jersey called Metatopia. A few of my fellow designers invited me to join them, and I was instantly hooked.
Oh, were they designing the game there?
No. They were just unwinding after like a day of pimping their own games.
as a fun after-work game. Right?
Yeah, it was something to just chill out with after their hard day at the convention.
So chill with a little gaming after a hard day of gaming. I get it.
That's how gamers do it, you know?
Hell yeah.
Now that's a good job. So tell us a little bit about how it's played.
In Spyfall 2, players are given the role of a member of a cabal of spies secretly setting a meeting place, or a lone infiltrator trying to cautiously discover where the covert operation will take place before being unmasked. Both the spies and the infiltrator will take turns crafting questions to try to figure out who's who. If they're too subtle, they may raise suspicion of their teammates. Too specific, and they could give away their role or the location. The game is played in several timed rounds. At any time during a round, one player may accuse another of being a spy. If all other players agree with the accusation, the round ends and the accused player has to reveal his identity. If the spy is uncovered, all other players score points. However, the spy can himself stop a round, announcing that he understands what the secret location is. If his guess is correct, only the spy scores points. After a few rounds of guessing, suspicion, and bluffing, the game ends and whoever scored the most points is victorious.
And why'd you bring it to the table, Mike?
I wanted to see my friends roleplay their way through kind of a subtle deduction game.
How subtle were we? Let's find out.
Yeah, let us find out indeed.
So, Joe, you were at the table for this game. What did you think?
Let me tell you something about the spy business. Coming home from very lonely places, we all go a little mad, whether from great personal success or just an all-night drive. We are each the sole survivor of a world no one else has ever seen.
Ed, how about you?
Hey, you better not be looking at me. That guy Evan over there, he totally depart.
Evan, how about you?
I spy with my little eye. Oh, wait, wrong game. Spyfall 2, it's like a version of 20 questions that need only a few questions actually to solve.
Yeah. And Mike, how about you?
It's got a high player count. Everyone stays engaged. That's two boxes that I like to check. And so that game did just that.
So I agree with Ed. Where you are looking while you play this game can indeed affect who wins. So I was glad that the game designers gave me such jam-packed images to look at. And Mike had a good rule of thumb for the game about looking in the center.
There's a bunch of different locations on the board, and there's the centerpiece that has them all on there. And if you're the spy, you're not sure where the actual location is. That's kind of your job to uncover it. So if you catch the one person just staring at the middle of the board, like looking at all the different locations, sometimes it can give them away as the spy just through the metagame. But I do it on every round. Yeah, I do it purposely on every round. It kind of helps people to not think that I'm the spy later because I do it all the time anyway.
Yeah,
regardless.
You throw them off that way.
They just put a picture of every location on one big picture map that was the centerfold of their rule book. It's useful for the non-spies because They're trying to describe their location when they're asked questions, but they don't want to be too specific because you don't want the spy to find out. So if you're looking at all the locations at once, you can craft your answers to match more than one location.
Exactly. And you should do that too. It's suggested that because you don't want the spy to narrow it down too much. Yeah.
I don't know what the rule book says in this regard, but everybody has their own card. So if you're not the spy, you can look at your card to see, describe your location. But the spy, if you try to look at a card, just going to see, basically says that you're a spy. So unless you're using that cheat sheet in the middle, you're not going to really be able to either describe the location very well or know what the other options are.
It's very, very clever the way they put those locations together.
Yes, there's lots of overlapping information in the locations.
Yeah, and yet also not completely unique in its own way. They share unusual commonalities that don't match up, too. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to deduce any of the locations from just hearing one clue or two clues, because
if you're careful,
you know, certainly with any one clue, it's going to match up to more than one of those. I mean, how many of them are there in all 16?
The box says experience 20 delicious new locations. So yes, 20.
Delicious. I would like to clarify for the audience, all players are in the same single location each round, which is something I didn't catch on until we played the first round. I thought everybody had their own location. And I'm like, how's this going to work?
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, okay, now it makes sense.
Right. Except the spy doesn't know what the location is. Yeah.
Correct.
And I think for that reason, I don't think the game would work in a very large group because everybody would have to be looking at this center sheet and, you know, in a crowded table, that could be a problem.
Yeah, I was actually thinking it'd be cool to put it on like an overhead projector or something like that, have a big screen that everybody can kind of
that
look
would be
at.
Neat.
Yeah.
Or have multiple sheets.
Yeah, it does say 3 to 12 players. Yeah.
Yeah, this Spyfall 2 expands to 12.
Yeah, I think you could get away pretty easily with 8 if you had a good sized table, but it would get dodgy after that.
I wonder if there's a phone reference for it.
There are details in these pictures that you really need to start looking deeply into, and
yeah,
some of the
do.
Images and some of the references are very small.
Uh-huh.
So you wind up, well, at least for me, and my eyes are getting old and tired as I age. I'm bringing my head and my face closer and closer to the sheet to actually kind of, okay, what's really going on in this section number 14?
The questions are the really important thing, like which kind of questions you ask. They do have to be subtle. I played one of the older versions of this game, Spyfall 1. One of the locations was the bank, and the clue that I gave to make sure everybody else knew I wasn't the spy was I asked, "Do you feel safe there?" Throw in the word safe because there's a big safe in the picture.
Oh,
but, you know,
so cool.
But it also could, right, you know, so you have to craft your questions carefully.
Yeah, it rewards both the intuitive player and the imaginative player because the pictures are really just a launch point for what you could be talking about.
Celeste, I loved one of the questions that you kept asking. It was your starter question was, I think it was, what does it smell like there?
Yeah, my strategy was to use questions with speculative answers, not concrete answers. And just like you, Mikey, we're trying to look at the board, look at the pictures all the time to help obfuscate the turns when you were actually the spy. I was doing the same thing with those questions, whether I knew the location or not. So when I was the spy, I could ask the same thing and not give myself away.
It does risk the other player giving you a heavy-handed answer to it, though. Like, it smells like cigarette smoke might be too, like, narrow it down too much, you know?
But I also like the fact that it requires people to be imaginative if you ask them something mm-hmm. speculative like that, which is always fun to see what people will answer.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason I brought it. Yeah.
But you know, the flip side of that coin is that the people who choose to not be creative with their questions will really reveal things quite quickly.
That's what I'm banking on when I'm the spy. Ed was giving too much away with a lot of his stuff because he's like business attire.
Although I didn't find myself brave enough to actually make any accusations after like the first or second question was asked, I did find sort of this tendency that I was maybe able to crack the game based on the first and second question. So I took just a private score in my head of how that worked out. And I was more right than wrong in having made those initial guesses based on one question or two questions at most.
The designers probably had an idea of keeping the game moving, too. I mean, there was probably a sweet spot between it being too difficult or too easy. on there. You don't want, you know, people to be stuck for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, sure. And a lot of that has to do with, as Mike said, the people you're playing
yeah.
with. I
guess. Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely the people yes. you're playing with a big factor. I can compare the game a lot to something like Werewolf, where who you're playing with and the amount of role-playing you're doing it make the game either fun or less fun.
It's a good way to get to know somebody you don't know, but also it's the game, I think, gets a little more interesting and intense when you play it with people you know really well.
Yeah, I think another interesting aspect is how the game suggests this once you get into it to try a little bit of role-playing. Each of the location cards has a different role on it, even though it's the same location.
Yeah, that changes the game a lot.
Yeah, it was a neat little element to add, sure.
Yeah, it actually, I think, gives a little bit more help to the spy, because the mm-hmm. spy can just come up with a personality that might fit into that. To any location, like, and they can give a little more vague of an answer because they're role playing out, like, "Hey, I'm working here," you know. That could apply to almost anywhere.
That's right.
Yeah, it might. Although I think it's a bigger challenge for the spy because the minute we added in the characters and I was the spy, I actually knew what location it was, and you guys were still doubting me. And it was like, we were at the construction site and I was like, "It's right here in the book," I was saying as the character, as an answer. And you guys were like, "No yeah. way." You know, it can be dodgy because you do have to, then you're not just trying to guess the location. You're also trying to play a character that might work there.
I thought it was a clever way to change the game up a little bit though, with a nice simple tweak like that.
Oh yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the art. The art was mm-hmm. really, I thought, a really great choice. It was cartoony, but very vibrant, very colorful. And the people in the pictures were always doing something in their location. It really made it feel like a vibrant world.
Yeah, and they did some interesting point of view angles for some of these pictures as well. Like you were mentioning the selfie, the track runner. Those are two good examples, Celeste. So from certain perspectives, very, very clever.
Yeah, there's a lot of activity in them, which is great.
People are raising hands or falling over something yeah. or, you know, laughing with someone. There's action.
Yeah, it's kind of challenging, too. Imagine trying to convey action at the UN.
Well, yeah, that was the only place that I think people might have been asleep. Yeah.
Right.
It definitely added a sense of urgency to the game, which I liked. It made that feeling of for this when I was the spy, it made it feel more intense, which I liked a lot.
Yeah, the whole game is on a timer and you can kind of choose how much time. They give suggested times, but you get to choose how much time you want to play each round for and how many rounds you want to play for as well.
Okay, so it's time to decide whether or not to dig up or bury Spyfall 2. Joe, what do you think?
I would dig this up for fairly large social situations if you have, you know, 7 people or 8 people or even like 10 people.
And Evan, how about you?
I think I'll be going against the majority today. I'm going to bury it because I think a game that can be cracked too early, at least that was my experience, it can be cracked, it can be broken. So I'll bury it.
Okay. And Ed, how about you?
It's not my type of game, but I think it's a decent social deduction game. But it has some flaws. I think the main problem for me is that I think it would be helpful if everybody had their own cheat sheet. So I personally bury it, but I'm sure it'll be fun for a lot of people.
And Mike, how about you?
Crafting clever questions and watching people try to interpret the true meaning is always fun for me. So I say dig it up.
Yeah, I'm going to say dig it up too. This game did make me want to memorize all the locations so I could get really good at being both the spy and the agent. Mike, where can you find this game?
I got it at my local game store for about $25. The name of the place was called the 20-Sided Store. I love
Ooh.
That. Lots of local game stores carry it, and if you're being lazy, you can also go online and buy it.
Lazy?
You don't want to visit your cool local game store. Instead, you want to sit at home and click on a button.
You know, or have 3 kids, whatever, you know.
Yeah. I'm trying to encourage people to go to the local store.
Oh, I sure do want to visit it.
They have to put pants on if you go out.
I know. Pants is a big detriment there. I get it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you have thoughts about Spyfall 2, let us know. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Which Game First. We'd love to hear from you. Up next, we have London, the second edition, designed by Martin Wallace. First published by Tree Frog Games in 2010, we played the second edition from Osprey Games in 2017. Number of players 2 to 4, ages 14 and up, runtime 60 to 90 minutes. Ed, you brought this game to the table. Where'd you find it?
I picked the first edition up when the game first came out as a fan of Martin Wallace, and I enjoyed it then. So when the second edition came up, I picked it up right off the internet.
And tell us a little bit about how it's played.
In London, you take the role of a prominent architect tasked with rebuilding the city after the Great Fire of 1666. Players start with £5 and a handful of cards. On your turn, you first draw a new card and then take an action. Actions can be either drawing 3 more cards, developing your city, running your city, or buying land. Running the city will give you different benefits depending on how you built it up in previous turns, and it'll also generate poverty based on the size of your cities. And then buying land grants you prestige and an opportunity to reduce poverty. The game ends when the city deck runs out, and the player with the most prestige wins the game.
So why did you bring it to the group?
Except for Evan, I think. We've all played the first edition. And then as a designer, it's always interesting to see what changes another designer makes when they re-implement the game they made. So he made some interesting changes in this game and kept the gameplay pretty much the same. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, we want to thank our friend Doug, who played the game with Joe and Ed during our exploration of this game. And Evan, Mike, and I are ready with questions. Joe, what did you think of the game?
I loved the history in this game, and I really liked the way it flowed.
And Ed, how about you?
I think it's a very pretty card game where you try to build an economic engine without being buried in poverty. It's a Martin Wallace game, so expecting black cubes.
Black cubes, yay. Evan, how about you?
Well, building and running neighborhoods in the city of London, but beware of things like corruption and poverty. It sounds easy, but as real life often reminds us, it's more complex than that.
And Mike, how about you?
Well, I didn't get a chance to play, but if crushing debt is a central theme, I would approach this one very cautiously. I'm looking at you, Martin Wallace.
Yeah, for real. I mean, just hearing about this game is giving me budgeting jitters. I could see myself getting crushed by loans in this game.
You don't remember, Celeste, but you actually played the first edition of the game.
Yeah, no, I do, vaguely. A long time ago. Yeah, so what did you guys find to be, like, the most interesting aspect of this game?
For me, I like the building a little engine and then running it.
I know there was a big difference between the first and second edition. One of the big differences was they eliminated the board on the second edition, right, Joe?
Yes.
The borough cards?
Yes.
Right, and you like that better than the map?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's like breaking Manhattan into its different neighborhoods or something. I mean, when you actually take the different characteristics of how the local geography and the local population affect what happens in the game, then it makes each section of the city sort of, you know, leaps out with its own character. And it emphasizes how different parts of a city can seem like entirely different worlds. Because the rules of the game you're playing change going from one to another.
That's cool.
Yeah, for me, I think that what's interesting is what I had before is the map, which is just like, oh, you just put a token on there, you get whatever immediate benefits from there, and that's it. Now, with the larger bureau cards, they have nice colorful art on them, and they have an opportunity to give each of the bureaus their own characteristics with a little special ability in some cases.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And the art throughout the game, I think, is actually very nice.
Yeah, the art is beautiful in this edition. I am a self-professed poor man's Anglophile. I was really sorry to miss this game because it looked to me quintessentially English in its art style. It actually, you know, with the muted colors and earth tones that they use and the gentle pencil lines of all of the drawings, even though they were impeccably drawn, it reminded me of almost like a Beatrix Potter feel to the drawings. Very English.
Yeah, it looks really nice, I thought. They have almost like a watercolor look.
Yes, almost.
Each borough, it was, you know, important to note. Does this borough border the river? Is it north of the river or south of the river? And those were always important decisions about, you know, whether or not you wanted to get involved with, you know, with the borough there or stop one of your opponents from getting involved there.
Huh.
I don't see how you can think of London without thinking of Thames. Yeah.
Right. So, guys, you know I tend to play aggressively with a lot of games.
It's okay. We've learned how to duck and cover.
Right.
Right. So I wonder, with an aggressive strategy like mine, would I have launched a strategy? Is it likely in this game that would have buried myself in debt?
It's possible. And Martin Wallace does include debts and loans in these games often. And sometimes there's a balancing act. Sometimes you really can get ahead with the loans, even though it punishes you a little bit because you have to pay back more than the loan gives you. But maybe it gives you an advantage right when you needed it.
The loans seemed so oppressive that at one point, Doug began yelling, usury.
get rid of a 10-pound loan, you must pay 15 at the start of your turn. Turn the loan and the money to the supply.
Positively confiscatory.
Usury.
The payback amount is what? What's like the interest rate on these loans? What are we talking about here?
50%.
No.
You borrow 10, pay back 15.
Holy cow. Oh, I would have been murdered.
You were asking about Doug. Yeah, he did mention about the debt, and he did get into some, but he ultimately won the game, so yeah. I think it worked out okay for him.
Okay. All right. That's good to know.
See, I don't know. My play style values efficiency and avoiding debt. So, I mean, oftentimes it's to my detriment. That's why I have a tough time with Wallace's games. It's one of my big weaknesses. But I have a question. Is debt inevitable in this game? Can you get by, like, keeping everything balanced and even? Or do you have to go into debt?
You can. I took out one loan or maybe two max, and I just decided to wait to take out the loan until I was very confident I could pay it off in one or two turns. And I didn't spend much time in debt at all. And I came very close to winning.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. I touched on the word corruption earlier. Mm. Can you explain a little bit how that comes into play?
Well, corruption, I think you mean poverty. You generally get poverty in a couple ways. Some of the improvements you build might generate good benefits, but a little bit of poverty. But the biggest factor is the balance of how big you build your city up before you run it, because you get poverty equal to the number of cards you develop into your city each turn. So there's a little bit of a balancing act between trying to get a large city, which makes it action efficient, or a small city, which is less action efficient, but you generate less poverty.
Yeah, I would also be against poverty if I was playing. I'd try to avoid all those. I like to avoid the negative effects in games as much as I can, actually. You know, I don't need to relive my actual life.
First thing I thought, I'm like, is this going to feel like work?
Poverty is kind of like a drain on you.
Yes, right. It's disgusting.
Bloody poor people in my district.
Yeah. Someone start a jobs program. For the love of God.
Poverty and crushing debt.
There are also different things that you can put down that eliminate poverty as a matter of course, and the cards just eliminate some poverty or some corruption or some crime, like streetlights or sewers. If you're willing to put in the extra money to make the place, you know, cleaner or safer, then the game rewards you for that with a reduction in the poverty.
I kind of appreciate the deep dive he takes into stuff like that. I mean, think about it. It's a board game. He's talking about street lamps and, like, garbage collection.
These were big innovation back in that day.
Yeah, he puts the research in, and I appreciate that.
I don't remember if there was a Cat's Meat Man card over there, but, I mean, that was one of the first things they did. If we actually take old meat scraps unfit for human consumption and we go from street to street and pass them out to the cats,
there you go.
That means more cats will be on those streets, and there will be less rats on those streets.
That's an expansion set for London.
Yeah, but did the Rat Catcher Union frown on that? I mean, because it kind of put them out of work. Yeah.
Cats, rats, and a plague.
It's time to decide whether or not to dig up or bury London. Joe, what do you say?
It's digger upper. I like games of building and rebuilding. And specifically with London, I really love the tactical tangle of, you know, how many cards to lay down.
Evan, how about you?
Didn't play, can't say. But if my co-hosts all say dig it up, I'm confident I'll enjoy playing it.
Mike, how about you?
I appreciate Martin Wallace for a good balance in his games, but I hate him so much for making me feel uneasy and poor. This one does sound pretty good, so I'll withhold judgment until I actually play it.
Ed, how about you?
I like engine building games, and this one had great art and some interesting choices, so I dig it up.
Jeez, you sure do like engine building
games,
Ed.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I will also reserve my final word, but the art in this game, I mean, I can't stress enough how beautiful it is. And it is definitely interesting enough to engage me at the very least in trying this game out. And when it comes to engine building games, I do need good art to keep me going. Ed, where can you find this, or how much is this game and where can you find it?
The game goes for about $55 MSRP, and the second edition is generally available because it's new. You can find it at your local game store or online.
And if you have thoughts about London, first edition, second edition, The Great Fire, first one or the second one, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know. We're at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Which game first? And our last game up this week is the T-shirt game, designed by, okay. And I cannot believe there are three designers for this game, Garrett J. Donner, Wendy L. Harris, and Michael S. Steer. And it was published by Buffalo Games in 2007. Number of players 3 to 6, ages 14 and up. Runtime 30 minutes. I brought this game to the table, and I got it at a downtown thrift store near me for $2.
Awesome. I love it.
This game this game's got a very, very short spiel. Everyone gets dealt 5 slogan cards, each with a T-shirt slogan on it. The judge player for each round draws a T-shirt card that he will judge. Everyone else puts in a slogan card from their hand for the judge to look at. The judge then picks the slogan that she thinks best matches the T-shirt image. The owner of that slogan card wins the round. There is a small additional game mechanic here, though, and that is the winner of each round doesn't get the same points for winning. Rather, each winner draws a hot or not card, which has a funny explanation as to how well or poorly their T-shirt fared at market, and it awards points accordingly. I brought this game to the table because I love card judging games. And just like most things that I love, I want to experience them in as many iterations as possible, which has led me to sit through some spectacularly eccentric productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream. But that is a different podcast. So, Mike, we were all at the table for this one, right? Yeah. Mike, what did you think of it?
Oh, you don't like my shirt? Well, that's just like your opinion, man.
Joe, how about you?
For a game where you're trying to match T-shirt art with T-shirt copy in random draws, a surprisingly high number of combinations end up reasonably funny. I mean, these were well done.
And Evan, how about you?
Yet another silly party game, but the world is full of silly people and they need to play games too.
What? I beg your pardon. Ed, how about you?
Try to pick a slogan that best matches the T-shirt, in the opinion of the judge. I think I've seen this mechanic somewhere.
A fruit comparison game, perhaps?
Yeah, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, so as Ed alludes, it is basically apples to apples style subjective judgment game.
Oh, that's right.
Which there are many of. But this one has some solid satire about it, you know, especially about the fickle nature of pop culture and of business ventures.
Yes, it does. The cards you get for the hot or not are just hysterical.
They are. They're so. It's a clever addition to the judgment, to the card judging game design. I really like that they randomize the points you get. So it's not just first person to 5 cards wins. I like that a lot. And,
right.
And
it's really, really random.
Though. Random points, you know.
That is the fickle nature of pop culture. I thought it was very representative.
I feel like if you win a round, you should get a little more than $3 in comparison to $17,000. You know, just saying.
Yeah, $3.14.
You get pie, $3.14. Yes.
You could get $5 or $5,000, yeah. Right, for a T-shirt idea.
Right.
But I think that's pretty realistic. I mean, some spectacularly awesome T-shirts go completely unnoticed, and some really lame ones make a fortune.
No, that's true.
So I think that was pretty good. All right. Yeah. My turn, people.
You're able to fight off a band of angry moths with this T-shirt. Nice work. 750 points.
I won twice and I'm at 600.
There's a card in there for like 25.
I thought you liked the randomness of this game,
yeah,
Celeste.
I do.
I mean, that is the one aspect of the game that makes them seem at least not like a complete straight ripoff of apples to apples. It does have its own mechanic.
it does have its own mechanic. Another thing that's very different from it is that you can actually steal other people's points with a Booyah card.
Booyah! Hey, great job designing that T-shirt. Oh, thank you, Booyah!
I'm just going to steal those points. Thank you very much.
It does. It's all right. It keeps people engaged.
And I mean, I cannot believe the amount of cards that came in this game. I mean, by the nature of card judging games, you do need a lot of cards to make it work. It was really great that this game had 2 different shaped cards. I thought that was really neat. The T-shirt cards are actually shaped like a T-shirt. And I liked the pictures that were on the t-shirts. There were tons of pictures, simple drawn cartoons, but definitely enough to get the imagination going and enough to like inspire humor.
Oh, we laughed once or twice, I think.
Yeah, there were some laughs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, silly pictures like a chubby lady looking in a funhouse mirror, you know, or a giant angry candy bar with arms and legs. Or I like the one where the four surgeons were like looking down at the operating table and it's like the patient eye view. And I mean, that sets it up for a good slogan, right?
Yeah, it's just like making memes, you know?
And there are some that are perennial winners. One that was in this game that was a perennial winner was, excuse me, do you have any Grey Poupon? Which surprisingly goes with almost every cartoon in the game.
Everything. Right.
Surgeons looking down at you with their operating instruments and you look up at them and say, excuse me, do you have any Grey Poupon? I mean, that works.
It does.
Too many times you don't have any good matches. And that to me was a little frustrating.
Yeah, it's like any of these matching games like this. A lot of times you'll have a handful of stuff that's just not going to work. I mean, on the upside, that point scoring thing at least allows you also for a definitive end to the game.
Yeah, I found the hot or not cards to be more engrossing. I really did.
Yeah.
I thought the humor that was on them was pretty funny.
The game is swingy, certainly. When we played it, we spent about 45 minutes playing to completion, and I was in last place the whole game until the last three hands, and then I earned enough points in those three hands to win. Went from last to first in about 3 minutes.
Yeah, I had like seven or eight cards, and I was still behind somehow.
I mean, that's the thing, though. Okay, look, we do complain about randomization in some games, right, where winning feels random. But in this game, I felt like it had a narrative reason for being so random.
All right, I'll give you that.
You know, making t-shirts is a fickle business. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. All right. I think you're convincing me here.
I mean, I wasn't exactly sure it needed another random element, but it did work to make you pay attention to what point people had.
Celeste, you're saying it's a true-to-life game,
Yes.
This is exactly how the t-shirt industry works.
$5 or $50,000. Who knows?
Who knows what's going to work? Yeah.
Or possibly the gaming industry or possibly the podcasting industry. Yeah.
Right. Anybody listening right now?
Hello, hello. Excuse me, do you have any Grey Poupon?
See, it works on every level.
Okay, it's time to pull on our t-shirts and find out whether they say dig up or bury the t-shirt game. Evan, what does your t-shirt say?
For as much as I like exercising my creativity with words and phrases, the game did not capture my interest enough in which I see myself playing it again anytime soon, so I'm going to have to bury it.
And Joe, how about you?
It didn't knock my socks off, but in a straight up or down vote like this, I'd have to rank it as wheat, not chaff. Dig it up.
Right. Ed, how about you?
If you love or even like Apples or Cards Against Humanity, then it's worth checking out as an alternative to those. I would leave it in the dirt for one of those gamers to find.
And Mike, how about you?
It's a decent game for its category. If I was with a real casual group of gamers and it was the only thing around, I would reluctantly dig it up. It has enough humor to get by on.
Gee, you didn't qualify that at all.
Glowing review for this game. It's not horrible. I play it in a pinch.
That's as close to burying a dig it up as I've ever heard.
Yeah. It is close to burying it as you can be and still be dig it up. That's a good way to say it.
Okay. All right. Well, I will, of the bunch, definitely give it the most resounding dig it up. I liked it. I like card judgment games, so that does qualify it for me. But I enjoyed it. And among those, I found it to be one of the better ones. So I definitely say dig it up. My t-shirt says dig it up. This game is out of print, but it is widely available.
Oh, no.
Out of print.
Yeah, but it's widely available. I mean, there were a gazillion copies of this game, I think, made. And you can get it online for about $15 or, you know, probably at your local thrift shop. So if you have thoughts about the t-shirt game, let us know. I definitely want to hear from you. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Which Game First. And that brings us to the end of our show. We look forward to hearing about all the game exploring you've done. You can follow us on your favorite social media. We are at Which Game First on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can support this podcast at patreon.com/whichgamefirst or go to our website for more information. Supporters of this podcast get additional episodes exclusive to them. And if you get a chance, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps others find the show. Join our chat on Discord. We are at Which Game First. And our Patreon subscribers get access to exclusive channels. Okay, game explorers, roll those dice, draw those cards, stack those cubes. Happy gaming, everybody.
Happy gaming.
Cubes. Tasty cubes.
You look marvelous.
You look marvelous.